I'm Stuck Mike at AirVenture 2009. At the Federal Pavilion, U.S. Customs and Border Protection, part of the Department of Homeland Security, has brought one of its Predator unmanned aerial vehicles to AirVenture, along with its mobile command center, actually a modified NASCAR trailer that houses the pilot and flight crew for Predator missions. Pete McNall is the Director of Unmanned Aerial Services for Customs and Border Protection.
Well, right now we're operating the Predator from two locations in the United States. In fact, really three. We just came back from an operation in upstate New York out of Fort Drum. We are operating out of Sierra Vista, Arizona, and Grand Forks Air Force Base in North Dakota. So each day we are taking off from those locations, climbing up into the National Airspace System and operating on an IFR flight plan in support of border security missions. So I'd say we're fully integrated in the National Airspace System today.
Would a pilot on frequency know that he was communicating with a pilot who's not actually inside his aircraft?
No, he wouldn't know that unless he knew our call sign. But our operation in the National Airspace System is transparent. We communicate on the same frequencies that general aviation pilots do. We follow our IFR flight plans like any other general aviation pilot does. So he would not know that it is an unmanned aircraft.
What do you say to the pilot who's naturally apprehensive about not being able to look the other guy in the eyeballs if spacing is a little uncomfortable?
Well, there's a couple of safeguards that are already in place. Number one, when we operate from a joint use field like we do in Arizona, the airspace is segregated in that there isn't an unmanned aircraft and a manned aircraft in the pattern at the same time. So some of those concerns that he may have already been mitigated by policy via the FAA. The second thing I would tell you is that our pilots are as concerned as general aviation pilots in maintaining separation and safe airspace requirements. So we have pilots flying that are certified FAA pilots. We are cognizant of other pilots' concern for see and avoid. We can use our camera system to provide some level of see and avoid in that it is capable of 360-degree articulation.
But there's only one view at a time, right? And it's
No, that's not really true. We have a view from the nose camera that's fixed, either day TV or IR, and then we have our payload camera that's slewable that we can move to any position, except probably for the tail. There are some parts that are going to be obscured because of the fuselage of the aircraft. But anything basically below the aircraft we could see if we had a clock angle and distance.
Talk about the aircraft in terms of some of the performance numbers that would be meaningful to a pilot. I mean, are they going to see sudden movements on the horizon and think that was either a UFO or a Predator? I don't know which.
Well, I can speak to how the aircraft is operated in Sierra Vista, where we climb in Class D airspace using ground observers to provide separation for us. Once we're in the restricted area, obviously aircraft are only allowed in there with permission. We're up in the National Airspace on an IFR flight plan talking to Albuquerque Center. So we are being afforded the same separation that anyone else on an IFR flight plan is afforded. I think the most significant thing about the aircraft for general aviation pilots that are here at Oshkosh is the size. So sitting here looking at the aircraft, 39 feet long with a 66-foot wingspan, it would be hard to miss. Flying as a general aviator flying in the airspace. Even though it's kind of painted with a low IR paint signature, it does have a big blue stripe on it. And we do carry navigation lights, so we're not totally undetectable.
Talk about the missions that this airplane's used for.
I just spoke of one of the missions we had up in Lake Ontario, St. Lawrence Seaway, which was a 30-day mission. Working up there in some new airspace, new controllers with our partners from Canada and our partners from ICE, DEA, and Border Patrol. So that was one mission. That's a law enforcement mission. We're doing law enforcement mission and humanitarian missions both on the northern border and the southwest border. Just 3 months ago, we were up doing some work for FEMA when the Red River flooded. We were doing some synthetic aperture radar work and being able to do a pre- and post-assessment of the river as it reached its flood stages. Last year and this year again, if we're called into service, we supported hurricane operations out of Corpus Christi, where we did pre- and post-landfall assessments for both Hurricanes Gustav and Ike. So law enforcement missions, obviously our mission in CBP is to secure our nation's borders. That's our primary mission. We can do that, simultaneously support other emerging natural emergencies as they come about and people ask us to support them.
Do UAV pilots operate under any kinds of communication constraints related to the missions or security around them?
No, we operate the same level and type of aviation radios that anyone in a Cessna 150 or 172 would. So if you were standing by or holding short as we taxied out at Sierra Vista, which is a joint use field in Arizona, we would be up ground, we would be up tower. We could hear you communicate, you can hear us communicate. So there is some communications that we communicate, that we use to talk to agents on the ground, which is secure, that would not be privy to a general aviation pilot. But aviation-wise, we're talking on the same frequencies, same spectrum of frequencies that anyone flying in the national airspace would.
As a pilot, your experience certainly goes further back than flying unmanned. What's the biggest challenge at piloting a Predator?
The biggest challenge is that we aren't sitting in the cockpit of an airplane. The technology puts us virtually in the aircraft from distances from 20 feet to distances of 3,000 or 4,000 miles. The biggest risk with this aircraft is that we are not flying real time, that the view that we see when we land 8,500-pound aircraft is what the world looked like 0.2 milliseconds ago. So that is the largest challenge flying this aircraft, is not having real-time imagery and not having all the sensory cues. Can't hear the engine speed, can't feel the wind, can't see the aircraft moving across the runway like you would in a manned aircraft. And obviously, there's no peripheral vision. So those are the biggest challenges.
Do you have the ability to get some situational information that a typical IFR pilot could not based on the way it's instrumented?
Yeah, we have a fairly complex system of sensors on the aircraft. We know immediately the aircraft weight. We know the wind direction by our GPS system in the aircraft. We can slew the camera system around to see if we are accumulating icing. A lot of those systems would not be available to the normal pilot flying an aircraft, maybe with the wing outside the view shed of the pilot. So we have telemetry that comes back to the ground control station. In fact, every second, 400 packets of data are coming down to the aircraft. So we know exactly how much gas is in each fuel cell. We know exactly where the aircraft is over the ground with a triple redundant flight control system and triple redundant navigation system. So a little different than someone out there flying on a VFR flight plan in southern Arizona.
How different is this aircraft from the ones used for national defense?
These are the exact same aircraft that are being flown in Iraq and Afghanistan. So they call it a Reaper. It's an MQ-9. The only difference between their aircraft and our aircraft is we're using it to secure our nation's borders. Those guys are over in Afghanistan and Iraq fighting the war on terror. So exact same aircraft, control system, exact same. Software may be a little different, modifications. Obviously, our system isn't weaponized where their system is. Could our aircraft be weaponized? Yes, it could be. But basically the same system being flown from the same ground control station that the Air Force flies.
So you can tell me absolutely that someone who sees a Predator flying in domestic airspace does not have to worry about it shooting at them.
Yeah. Yes, I can.
Well, you know, I make fun of sort of in that question, but really there is a kind of a Big Brother issue that does come to mind on this. I mean, since its sensing abilities are considerable and it can go all kinds of places and can do so, you know, relatively stealthily, governance over its use, I think probably is a legitimate question. So how do you make people feel comfortable when they worry that a tool like this is going to be used just to look at bad guys and not to look in windows?
Well, I think I said previous, to before it came on the air, I mean, those decisions, what we do with the aircraft, are not made at my level. I'm an operator. I follow the guidance that's provided for me from my leadership in Washington, D.C. This is a tool that we're using to secure our nation's borders. So if someone asks us to surveil a vehicle, if someone asks us to surveil a house, in the furtherance of a law enforcement mission, obviously we would do that. But we don't randomly pick out residences or locations on the border to invade the privacy of citizens. But I will go back and talk a little bit about the weaponization of an aircraft like this. If there was an emerging event that required us to weaponize the aircraft and our leadership asked us to do that, certainly that would be something that we would look into. I mean, the capabilities of this aircraft to fly in areas there that you wouldn't want to risk human life in the event of a nuclear explosion or dirty bomb, this would absolutely be the aircraft of choice for that.
Now, parked right next to the aircraft is the control is the mobile control station. Can you talk about how that's equipped? I mean, from here, it looks like an empty trailer with some electronics way up on one end of it.
Right. This is a NASCAR trailer that has been modified to accept two control racks. As you can see, the rack on the left side, rack on the right side, with a center console with DVR recorders, Super 8 recorders, and radios. The pilot is sitting in the left seat. The sensor operator is sitting in the right seat. Both control systems can do either mission. We can swap and put the pilot in the right seat if we want in the left seat. And then along the side of the trailer, it's 38 feet long, is positions for mission enhancements. There's one set for a synthetic aperture radar. That's where the operator sits. And then there's also a position for an avionics technician to sit. And every second, there is information being pumped up to the aircraft and comes down to the ground control station in terms of telemetry. And so we're able to monitor all the systems on the aircraft to include how much power we're drawing from a specific system, how much gas we're burning in a specific tank. And that's what he is. He's kind of like an onboard flight engineer. But that is pretty much the standard configuration that we're flying the Predator from throughout the United States right now.
What's the profile for loss of communications or control?
We have an emergency mission that is pre-programmed into the aircraft. And in the event that we lose command link with the aircraft will enter a pre-programmed mode. I can speak to it, what it is on the Arizona border. It's defined in the code that the FAA authorizes us to fly. If we go lost link, that's loss of command link with the aircraft will set up a loiter point and will orbit for 15 minutes in the airspace that it's assigned. That will give the command duty officer, myself, or any of the guys working time to contact Albuquerque Center, let them know what's going on with the aircraft. The aircraft will squawk 7600, which is loss of communications, and at the end of 15 minutes, it will fly back to Sierra Vista into the restricted airspace. It will be coordinated its entry over the telephone. It will set up a six-point orbit, and it will fly there till it runs out of gas, or we get control of it. All the spots that we use for lost link missions are all pre-surveyed because the aircraft could come back to Sierra Vista and at the end of its endurance run out of gas, the gear will lower and then it'll crash in a pre-designated area.
Wow, I had no idea.
Well,
that alone makes me feel better.
Well,
no, seriously, it does.
No, I mean, that is a deliberate mission that we have set up with the aircraft, set up at a specific altitude and airspeed. There's no guesswork. It's all done by software. I don't think there has ever been an aircraft, I think, in General Atomics history that has not followed the lost link profile, that has gone and loitered someplace else or crashed in an area that wasn't designated as a loiter point or crash recovery point. We have absolute confidence in that system that will bring the aircraft back to Sierra Vista. They'll allow us to gain control of it through another antenna, through another ground control station, and then land the aircraft safely.
I talked with an Air Force cadet who thinks it's entirely possible that he may not be flying a plane that he's actually in as the armed forces leverage unmanned vehicles increasingly. Is he focusing on the right stack of mail?
Well, certainly the emergence of unmanned vehicles in the military is prolific. I mean, they're being flown overseas. General Atomics just came out with a new prototype of a jet-driven Predator variant, Predator C. I mean, it certainly could happen. I mean, there's a large demand for these kind of systems that have these long endurance and great camera systems that can provide surveillance and situational awareness on the battlefield. Would I be disappointed if I got out of flight school and I wound up walking into a GCS instead of a cockpit on an F-16? Yeah, probably. You know, we don't wear white scarves and sunglasses in there. We can't feel the wind going through our hair, but I think that military pilots of all flavors are going to find themselves eventually doing a tour of service in an unmanned system. I think Secretary Gates mentioned a year ago that they need more Predator pilots. I mean, this is, you can send this out in harm's way, and if you lose one, hey, a big deal. You know, you're not losing there's not a guy on the ground evading the enemy with his risk of getting captured and maybe killed. So I'm not saying these are throwaway assets that $10 to $12 million a pop, but you don't have the loss of human life if this is shot down.
For Customs and Border Protection, is the plan to expand their use? Can you talk about what you see down the road?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you had the opportunity to hear the Assistant Commissioner speak this morning, I think our vision is a fleet of 18 aircraft, six down on the southwest border, six up on the northern border, and then a marinized version flying someplace out of Cape Canaveral or something like that. Two-thirds of the world is covered with water. It makes sense for us to have a system that we can deploy and detect vessels coming in to the United States to detect, and the ability to detect semi-submersibles coming from in and around Colombia that are carrying 10, 20 metric tons of cocaine. So that is the natural evolution of this system. I expect that that system would be available and online, hopefully, sometime in the spring. So first marinized version. Three aircraft down in Sierra Vista, two aircraft up on the northern border, an aircraft in mod right now for a marinized version, and that's just the beginning for us. So hopefully a fleet of 18, maybe not seen in my lifetime with Customs and Border Protection, but eventually that will happen.
Peter McNall, Director of Unmanned Aerial Operations for the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. On the field at AirVenture 09, I'm Stuck Mike.